Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. This is the course on the Gospel of John, lesson number 35, the trial by Pilate. We will be in John chapter 18, verse 28 through chapter 19, verse 18. I'm Matthew Gage. I appreciate you listening to this lesson. I hope that it is a help and a blessing to you. Now, as we saw in our last lesson, Christ has been arrested. He's been tried before the Jews. They have already decided they were going to kill him. It's just mere formality by this point. And I didn't get into it in that lesson, but everything they did basically was illegal. They weren't supposed to arrest people at night. I read somewhere. They could actually have a trial at night, but they could not pass judgment till the next morning. They could not call a meeting of the Sanhedrin, which was their Congress. They could not call a meeting of them into tonight. But so there's a number of things that they did that were flat illegal according to their customs and their laws. But it is no wonder that they would bypass all those because of their just hatred of Christ, their sheer hatred for their own Messiah, that they were going to stop at nothing to rid themselves of him. And that's exactly what they did. Now, what we're going to cover in today's lesson is very important. The Jews could put people to death. They did have that authority. We will see that in the book of Acts. When Stephen, they did not really have a trial. They just stoned him. So the way I kind of understand it, and I may be wrong on this, is basically if they could catch you in the act of blasphemy, they could kill you. But unfortunately, they could not catch Christ in the act. They knew what he had said, but because they couldn't catch him in the act of it, they could not simply put him to death. They had to have approval through the Roman government to have him executed. And you think, well, why is that so important? You know, Christ was just supposed to die, and he could have died by the hands of the Jews or the Romans. It didn't really matter. It actually does make a difference. The Jews executed people by stoning. You think, well, what does that have to do with anything? Well, the Romans executed people various different ways, but one of them, the most cruel version, was crucifixion, where they would nail an individual up to a cross. Sometimes they would hang them in trees. There's different variations. Perhaps sometimes they even would have them tied up there also with the nails. Seems like, I don't think they ever just tied somebody up there. They always put the nails in too. But anyway, that's the way Rome crucified its vilest offenders. This wasn't something they did just to somebody who stole a couple of dollars. This was how they treated the worst of the worst. You know, for instance, when Spartacus led his slave uprising in the 2nd century B.C., I may be wrong on that, 1st or 2nd century B.C., when Rome finally defeated him, they crucified hundreds and thousands of these slaves because they want to get the point across. We won't have our slaves up rebelling. We won't have them up in arms. So this wasn't just about how horrible it was for the person. It actually was showing the world you don't mess with Rome. And we'll get into that in the end of this, why Christ was crucified. But it does actually have a very important, a very, very important role in fulfilling prophecy and fulfilling scripture, because Christ said, "If I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto me." And it was quite clear he was talking about how he was going to die. You can't be lifted up when you're being stoned. When he was talking about being lifted up, he was talking about crucifixion. So this is very important in that it is setting up the crucifixion. It is setting up the curse from the Old Testament, cursed is him that hangeth upon a tree. So there's a lot of reason for this to be going on in a practical sense, because the trial by Pilate and his signing off on the sentence is going to pave the way for Christ to be crucified. But yet it goes much deeper than that. In the midst of this, we're going to see just how much the Jewish people, the Jewish rulers, had turned on their Messiah. You know, you think just a few short days before, they had been shouting Hosanna and waving palm fronds as Christ rode in the triumphal entry. And now they are clamoring for his death. And not just for his death, but the most vile, excruciating, humiliating form of death at the time, crucifixion. Now, the setting of this takes place early in the morning on Wednesday, the 14th of Nisan, the day of preparation before the Passover on Thursday. Now, these events have to take place before 9 a.m. That's about the time Christ was crucified. Now, we will see, I don't see it in the notes, I'll have to skim through here, but there's one part the time is actually mentioned, and it says that, I'm trying to skim through here and I don't see it. We'll cover it when we get to it, but there is an event that actually is timed. Oh, here it is, verse number 14 of chapter 19, and it was a preparation of Passover, that's the day before the Passover, at about the sixth hour. So, and the sixth hour would equate to 6, 7 a.m., something around that time. And according to Hebrew time, that's also very important there to keep everything straight. John evidently was using Hebrew time right there. So, but anyway, this is going to take place early in the morning. We're hours away from the crucifixion. And these events seem to take place in the fortress Antonia. Now, it's never named. There's a couple of places named in here in the Greek. In verse 28, it talks about the Hall of Judgment. In the Greek, that is Praetorium, or at least that'd be the Latinized form of the Greek word, but it's Praetorium. And the Praetorium basically is talking about the camp of the army, or the headquarters of the Roman official is what that's speaking of, the kind of a seat of government. So we don't know where that was. You know, it's not that was a specific building. It's just a term for the place. You know, it's just like you can say the courthouse, and you could say, I mean, that could be a specific place or in a broad general sense. And this evidently is in a general sense that this place is named. So we just know it's where the seat of government was. Now, because it's Passover, because there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of Jews gathered in Jerusalem to remind them who's in charge and to be there in case something happened, Rome actually would have a very strong presence there. Now, normally they held their seat of government in Caesarea, which was on the coast. But in times like these, a few times a year, you know, during the big feast when so many people were there, they would move their seat of government to Jerusalem and be on hand with a contingent of soldiers and just reminding people who's in charge and to be there in case something happened. So that's why Pilate is even there. Normally he would be in Caesarea, but he is not there. He's in Jerusalem. Why? Because there are hundreds of thousands of people there for the Passover. And so where would he be holding court? Where would he be running the territory? It could be a couple of different places, but from what I've read, I think it's pretty easy to assume that this is in the Fortress Antonia. The Fortress Antonia was a fort that was built next to the Temple Mount, and it was it actually was the site of a previous fort, I think going back for eons, perhaps. But this particular structure was built by Herod the Great, and it was named after his patron, Mark Antony. You remember him? If you remember your Roman history or Shakespeare, you'll remember Mark Antony. You know, Antony and Cleopatra, perhaps that might ring a bell. But anyway, Mark Antony was, of course, one of the leading figures in the pre-imperial Rome, and colleague of Julius Caesar, and how he had come to the East and set a lot of stuff in order. And one of the things he did was kind of straighten out a leadership problem there in Judea and help place his friend Herod in charge. So Herod was very grateful, of course, to Mark Antony, and did this and a few other things to kind of honor him. So, but anyway, he named this fort after that Mark Antony. And this was located just northwest of the temple. In fact, it's very interesting. Rome actually at one point built a tower so they could see over the wall into the temple and kind of monitor things. And the Jews did not appreciate this because they saw that as, you know, Rome infringing upon their sacred territory. So they actually built the wall bigger so they couldn't see over. So anyway, very, very interesting thing. But that is where I believe this takes place, is the Fortress Antonia. It's right there next to the temple, a short distance from Gordon's Calvary, if that makes a big difference. But anyway, I believe that's where it is. This Roman fort, it was not a giant fort or structure, but it would be a place where Pilate could be and be guarded safe in case of an insurrection or a riot, and you know, with plenty of soldiers around. So it seems to me a very logical place for them to be. And I'm sure I've rambled much longer on that than most people are interested. I love my history. So we'll jump right on in here, and we'll see, you know, of course, reminding you that the Jews have already had their trials, they've already condemned him, and they have sent him to Pilate, basically for the sentence to be approved. And verse number 28, then led they Jesus from Caiaphas, who of course was a high priest, unto the hall of judgment, and it was early. And they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Okay, this is going to set up something very interesting here. It's the 14th of Nisan, the day of preparation. And the day of preparation was when, you know, of course, they prepared for the Passover. Duh, that's why they named it that. But it also was when they killed the Passover lamb. And according to Jewish custom, if a Jew set foot inside the house of a Gentile, or I think even under the same roof with Gentile, I don't remember exactly right now, but if he entered the house of a Gentile, he was considered defiled, unclean, until the following evening. So if this is in the morning of the day of preparation, they would be unclean until the sun went down that day, which meant they could not kill their Passover lamb because they were ceremonially unclean. So the Jews basically pass off Christ, you know, through, you know, some Roman soldiers. They get, you know, give him to Pilate, and they stay outside. They refuse to go in. So they're not there shouting accusations and such during the interrogation and during the trial. They're outside. So we're going to see Pilate having, poor Pilate has to go back and forth. He goes in, talks to Christ, goes out, talks to Jews, go in, talks to Christ, goes out, talks to Jews. So he's back and forth quite a bit in this passage. So anyway, so we have Jesus. He's been handed over to Pilate, and the Jews are waiting outside. So verse 29, Pilate then went out unto them and said, what accusation bring ye against this man? Now, what I picture here, I don't know if this is historically correct or not, but I picture Pilate going out on a balcony, and there being like a forum type area, and that's where the Jewish rulers are gathered. And so Pilate is, you know, kind of elevated above them and being able to speak to them. And that type of thing existed in Roman architecture. I don't know if it existed here, but that's just kind of what I picture. And perhaps he, you know, just he walked outside the door and they're gathered around the street. I don't know. I picture Christ, or I picture, excuse me, picture Pilate walking out on the balcony. And first thing he says, well, what accusation bring you against this man? So he's like, okay, what are the charges? And verse 30, here's the response. This is very interesting to me. They answered and said unto him, if he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him up unto thee. So Pilate says, what's the charge? And they say, well, he's got to be a bad guy. He's there. You know, why would we bring him to you? So they don't ever, they don't give the accusation. They don't give the charge. All they do is say, well, he must be bad. He's there. You know, why would we bring him to you if he wasn't a bad guy? So Pilate, I think he rolls his eyes. Verse 31, then said Pilate unto them, take ye him and judge him according to your law. So it's like, look, okay, y'all guys, y'all just deal with him. And the Jews therefore said unto him, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death. Now that is technically not true, as we spoke before, because they didn't have any problem killing Stephen just a few years later. And, you know, there's records of people being stoned and stuff. So that is not completely true. But unfortunately, they evidently did not have the firm ground enough to do it themselves. And perhaps they themselves were fearing a riot of the people. If they crucified Christ or killed Christ, perhaps there would be an uprising of his followers and it would jeopardize their position and perhaps cost them their lives or they'd get kicked out of office. Or what it seems to be their biggest fear was Rome would interfere even more and they would lose their political power. So that seems to be the driving purpose, but behind much of what they're doing during this is they just don't want to lose their status. They don't want to lose their political position. So anyway, verse 32, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die. Now, I've already explained that. The Jews, of course, stone people, and the Romans, in this case, are going to crucify him. And that fits in with what Christ had spoken. And let's see, that's actually in John chapter 12, verse 32 and 33. You can look that up. It talks about him. It says, if I be lifted up. So, and then verse 32 actually says that's talking about how he would die. So it's clarified for us there. Verse 33. Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said unto him, art thou the king of the Jews? So Pilate's evidently heard of this guy. And so he wants to know if it's true. Are you really the king of the Jews? Verse 34. Now, notice here again, Christ isn't dodging the question. He's just turning it back on Pilate. Excuse me. Jesus answered him, sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it of me? So, tell it thee of me. Excuse me. So, Christ just looks at him and says, okay, are you saying that because you believe it or because you know it? Or did somebody tell you that's what I said? And verse 35, Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Thine own nation and chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? So Pilate's like, I don't care if you're the king of the Jews. I mean, I'm not a Jew. You're not my king. And he says, look, your own people, your own nation, your own flesh and blood, your own leaders, your own priest have turned you over to me to kill you. So it's like, what in the world? What hast thou done? What in the world did you do? Verse number 36. Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. Now, Christ is speaking of his spiritual kingdom, the kingdom of heaven. He's not speaking of an earthly throne. And that's what he is saying here, of course, in the typical, very picturesque way. That if it was a worldly kingdom, of course, yes, his followers would be out there beating down the door to rescue him. But they're not, because this is part of the plan. Because for the kingdom of heaven to exist, it's all based on Christ's blood. It's all based on his sacrifice. It's all based on the redemption of mankind. So that's what he's talking about. So, you know, his kingdom's not of this world. It's a spiritual, it's a heavenly kingdom. And verse 37, Pilate therefore said unto him, art thou a king then? So it's like, well, you said you had a kingdom. Are you really a king? Jesus answered, thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. So, once again, Jesus turns it on, and instead of speaking and answer the question, turns it to the spiritual, just like he does so many other times. And says, look, hey, you said I was a king. Yeah, that'll be good enough. And he says, this is why I was born. This is being a witness of the truth. What was he a witness of the truth of in the crucifixion? The love of God. He was a witness to the fact that God wanted to have a relationship with mankind. That God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. That's what he was a witness of. Verse number 38. And let's do 38 and 39. Pilate saith unto him, what is truth? Famous statement. I think Shakespeare ran with that one a little bit. And when he said this, he went out again unto the Jews and saith unto them, I find in him no fault at all. So, he's interrogating him and says, well, I don't know what truth is, because as I say, the Rome, truth, didn't matter. You just, loyalty to the state was supreme. And as far as religious things, it, just didn't really matter. You could serve a number of gods or one of them or a couple of them or just whichever ones you wanted to. So, it was very wishy-washy when it came to concrete truth as far as religious and spiritual things went. Verse 39, Pilate speaking to the Jews, but ye have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover. Will ye therefore that I release unto you the king of the Jews? Excuse me, I keep coughing. Now, this custom that he speaks of, this really, I believe, is the only reference to it. Now, why would they do this? I do not know. I don't know if this is keeping with an earlier custom that perhaps the Jews would release a prisoner on this day because this was a very special holy day. I don't think it would have anything to do with Rome trying to look like good guys and say, well, look, we'll show y'all how that we're not so bad and y'all can have one prisoner back. I don't think that it really does not fit in the character of Rome, because if you didn't like Rome, they didn't care. They just killed you and took your money. So I don't think that really factored into it. So evidently this was just, I think it was perhaps honoring a custom that was in place. From where and what the basis is of it, I don't know. We just know it was there. So Pilate sees this as a way he can get out of his mess, because he knows if he doesn't crucify Christ, the Jewish rulers are going to be upset with him. But he's afraid of crucifying because he believes he's innocent, which is really kind of amazing for a man like Pilate to even care about that, because most of the time Rome just, the innocence thing, especially with foreign people, was not that big a deal. Just kill them all, let God sort them out. That's almost the position they took. And Pilate was not known to be sympathetic to the Jews. He was not known to be a sympathetic person at all. The record we have of him, especially through like Josephus, is of a very dark individual. And in fact, one, he evidently had no care for the Jewish religion. Most of the other Roman rulers would at least, try to pacify the Jews. But it seems that Pilate did no such thing. His own coins have pagan images on that he had minted. And the other Roman procurators and such would never did that. They actually would use symbols on the coins that were kosher, that were acceptable by the Jews. They wheats or something along, or just text inside of a wreath. But Pilate actually put an augur staff, an augur, which was the Roman priest who would divine the will of the gods and fortune-telling through flight of birds, or the or cutting open a bird and looking at their entrails. That's what an auger was. So, Pilate was a pagan. He had no care at all for the Jewish religion. So I don't know why all of a sudden he would be sympathetic to them and do this. But evidently, as I think this just was a custom, and he was fulfilling it. So, and this was his, and saying, I think that, this was his way out of it, because this is easy. Okay, look, all right, y'all gave him to me. Look, I'll give him back to y'all, and I don't have to mess with him. Verse 40, then cried they all again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber. Barabbas, the name actually is Bar-Abbas. Bar being son, Abbas being father, so son of the father. So they traded the son of God the Father for a man named son of the father. And very ironic there in the scripture. And it says he was a robber. Now, just a common thief would not have been in line to be crucified, which it seems Barabbas was. It seems that Christ took the place of Barabbas. What was this man? Well, evidently he was something like a highwayman or a, as I was trying to explain this in my Sunday school class, somebody said it was kind of like Jesse James. And that, I guess that's a good, or at least a easy illustration for an American mind. Like, he was like a Billy the Kid. He led his outlaw band. He was not a good individual. And it may just not have been that he was just an outlaw. He very well could have been like an insurrectionist, that he was a rebel against Rome. And so why, if they're really concerned about, the Jews were concerned about their relationship with Rome, and the high priests were concerned about their relationship with Rome, why would they want to let loose someone who's going to bring turmoil and upset the apple cart? That just shows how much they wanted rid of Christ, that they would take one of the vilest criminals evidently in the country, and they would rather have him than the spotless Lamb of God. Now, we're going to continue on in chapter 19. I usually have tried to keep my lessons contained in one chapter, but to follow this story on, we need to keep going on a little bit further. So, chapter 19 and verse number 1. Let me look at my notes. Let's read the first three verses. Then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers plaited a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe and said, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they smote him with their hands. Now, what's happening here is Pilate is trying to pacify the Jews, and he's hoping that if he scourge Christ, if they beat him and ridiculed him, that that would be enough, that that would satisfy the passions of the mob. It did not have that effect. Now, as far as what is taking place here, this is called what the Romans would call, like, it was called the game of kings or the sport of kings. Rome didn't just want to beat you. They wanted to humiliate you. And if you were a leader of a rival faction or nation, they didn't just kill you. They would go out of their way to ridicule you. When they would capture the king of a nation they had been at war with, they would march him with the spoils through the great triumph that they would have at Rome and in the party that ensued with that. And at the end of the triumph, when they finally reached the central part of Rome, they would then just kill them. So they actually kept them alive just to ridicule them and show them off as a trophy, as a spoil of war, and then just kill them. They would strangle them, chop their head off, very unmerciful. There are some cases where they didn't quite follow that, but that generally was what they did. And basically, if someone stood against Rome, it was not taken lightly. They would humiliate them. And part of what's going on here is that Christ was the King of the Jews. And they were trying to ridicule him and ridicule the Jewish people. If he was the King of the Jews, they're going to show them their power over their king by beating him and ridiculing him and humiliating him. And in doing so, but of course, it was meant to humiliate Christ, but also it was meant to put the Jews in their place. And that's what's going on here. That talks about him scourging him, that they whipped him. That most people say the cat of nine tails, which is a whip with that would have branches off of it. And many, you know, nine, of course, with the name of the tile, but perhaps it had more or less. But it had many ends on it, and they would put tips of glass or bone or pottery in there. And so it wasn't just like being whipped with a horse whip. They actually, when they whip you with that, those would dig into the skin, and then when they pull it back, it would rip chunks of skin out. Very, very brutal thing. Verse 2 talks about the being planted with a crown of thorns. The thorns that most people believe the thorns are 2 or 3 inches long. Now, I've seen some thorns here in Texas on some different plants grow like that and be that long. And what it talks about is they made a crown and they put it on his head, and it says elsewhere that they actually beat it down on him with a pole. That was to ridicule him even further, that instead of having a royal golden crown, he's got the painful crown of thorns. That's something that no king would have. Then they put on him a purple robe. Purple, of course, was the color of royalty. In fact, it was actually taboo for a Roman to wear royalty or wear purple. The Romans hated kings. They did not want a king. They didn't mind having an emperor, but they hated kings. And this goes back to their early founding. They had some bad ones. And so during the Roman Republic, they refused. They would not have a king. And if somebody acted too much like a king, they got rid of them. And if somebody got too powerful and started acting a little bit too much like a king, they would be done with them. So, and they very rarely would wear purple, because purple was a color of royalty. And if someone was acting very powerful and showed up wearing purple, that usually turned public sentiment against him, because they did not want a king. Actually, their word for it was rex. They did not want a rex. So this is them ridiculing the King of the Jews. They beat him. They put an ugly, painful crown on him. They put a purple robe as if he was royalty. And verse 3, and they said, "Hail, King of the Jews." So they were even verbally making fun of him and accosting him and deriding him. And it says, and then they smote him with their hands. They actually beat him. So this was them. This was the Roman soldiers putting Christ in his place, and taking out their hatred for the Jews in the process. Now, from what I've read, these Roman soldiers were probably not Italian. They were probably not Roman blood. They seemed to be local troops, which was usually the case on the frontiers. So these probably were actually Syrian men that were employed in the legions. So they were not Jews. That's very obvious by historical standards. And they were not even Italian blood. So they were probably Syrian, which also would probably make this so much more fun for them, because they already hated the Jews. And this was, they got to, you know, have a little fun with one of them, so to speak. So now Pilate has had him beat. They've mocked him. They've scourged him. And Pilate is now going to present him again to the Jews. Verse 4, "Pilate therefore went forth again and saith unto them, Behold, I bring him forth to you, that ye may know that I find no fault in him." Well, it's funny, if you found no fault in him, why did you just beat him and ridicule him? But he did. Listen, Pilate was hoping that they would have compassion on him, or that their anger would be satisfied in this. In verse 5, then came Jesus forth, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate saith unto him, Behold the man! Very famous, you'll sometimes see this in Latin, Ecce Homo, which, you know, means behold the man. There's paintings presented and such of this. So this, here he is, Pilate is presenting him one last time. He says, there he is. Do you want him back? What should I do with him? I find no fault in him. There he is. So he's offering him back to the people. Verse number 6. When the chief priests, therefore, and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, Crucify him! Crucify him! So it wasn't just kill him, be done with him, take him away, lock him up. No, they wanted the most vicious, most humiliating form of execution in the ancient world to take place. They wanted him crucified. And Pilate saith unto them, Take ye him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him. So Pilate just throws his hands up and says, out of control in the situation, just take him away and crucify him. So now it's very interesting. The Jews, who could not come up with an accusation, now come up with an accusation in verse number 7. The Jews answered him, We have a law, and by our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God. So it seems like the Jews now are trying to, what's the word? I've lost the word there. They're trying to, oh my goodness, this is embarrassing. They're trying to justify their actions and by doing this. So they're like, okay, yeah, he's going to be killed. And by the way, yes, we have a law and he broke it and he should die. So Pilate, though, when he heard this, it scared him. Verse number 8. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was the more afraid. Now, why did that scare Pilate? What was it in that statement that would cause him to all of a sudden reconsider? Because he's going to bring Jesus back in and talk to him again. He's already condemned him to the cross, but why is he going to bring him back in? What was it about that? I've thought about this, and what I think this is the superstitious side of the Roman coming out. And when he heard that this man might very well be deity, Pilate got scared. He thought he had just ticked off the gods, which was something a Roman did not want to do. Romans were very superstitious people, very superstitious people. They refused to go to battle unless the signs and omens were right. They would turn public policy on its head just because of a bad omen. They were very, very superstitious people. And when he heard this man he just condemned to the cross was deity, or could have been deity, it scared him. I think this is because he's superstitious, and we'll see this. So verse 9, and went again into the judgment hall and saith unto Jesus, Whence art thou? But Jesus gave him no answer. So I think even you see in the question here that Pilate is very nervous. It's like, where did you come from? He wants to know. He's demanding here. He's very nervous. He wants to know, where did you come from? He's wanting to know, are you really a god? Are you really a deity? And, of course, Jesus does not answer him. Verse number 10. Then saith Pilate unto him, Speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have power to crucify thee and have power to release thee? So he's trying to scare him into he's flexing his muscle there before Christ, because he's saying, Look, you better answer me. I think he's desperate. I think he's scared. He's worked up. And he says, You had better answer me, because look, buddy, I can have you killed. You had better tell me the truth. Verse 11. Jesus answered, Thou couldest have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore, he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin. So, Jesus just points out, well, you think you have power? Well, the only reason you have power is because somebody above you gave it to you. And the words there, he's not talking necessarily about up the chain of command. He's not talking about Caesar. He's talking about God. So once again, the superstitious Roman, Christ is putting it right back on him, saying, well, you wouldn't even have power if it wasn't for, you know, heaven. So, you know, it's like, so Pilate, I think, must have taken that, well, you know, the only reason I'm here is because the heavens want me here, because the gods want me here. So I think Jesus kind of turning that back on him. Now, the last part of that verse is very interesting. It talks about that he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin. Who is that? Most of the commentaries I looked at believe that it's talking about the high priest. This talking about Caiaphas or Annas, or talking about the Jews, maybe in general. Because who was it that had already condemned him? It was the Jews. Pilate wasn't out looking to arrest him. The Jews brought him, brought Christ to him. So, so who it was that was delivered Christ to Pilate? It was the priesthood. It was the high priest. Now, whether that particularly is Annas or Caiaphas, you know. We got into explaining a little bit about that in the previous lesson. So, you know, I don't know which one he's specifically talking about as an individual. But I think what he's telling Pilate is that the person who's really wrong is not Pilate. The person who's really wrong is the ones that have rejected him as the Messiah, the ones who had the light and rejected the light. The superstitious Roman Pilate, he didn't have a whole lot of light. He really wasn't rejecting the truth he had been brought up in. This was his first encounter with the Son of God, with Christ. And the Jews had him for 3.5 years. They should have known who he was and what he was doing. So what Christ, I believe, he's talking about there, he's talking about the high priest. Verse number 12. And from thenceforth, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, if thou let this man go, thou art not Caesar's friend. Whosoever maketh himself a king speaketh against Caesar. So Pilate is scared by these sayings. You know, he thought he was dealing with a criminal and dealing with an insurrectionist. He did not realize he was dealing with a god. And that troubled him greatly. So he's seeking to release him. And when he goes back out to speak to the Jews and say, look, I didn't understand this. I want rid of this guy. I don't want nothing to do with this. The Jews then put the political pressure on him. How do you scare a politician? You threaten to throw him out of office. And that's what they do. So they say, look, if you let him go, you're not on the same side with Caesar. Your boss is not going to like it. And what they say there, whosoever makes himself a king speaketh against Caesar. Now, this is very interesting. They've already rejected Christ for Barabbas. Now they were rejecting Christ, their king, for the earthly king, the Caesar. Very interesting. Because the Jews hated Caesar. They despised him. They were looking for any way at all to overthrow the Roman yoke of bondage. In fact, about 35 years or so from now, from this point, they're going to be embroiled in a revolt against Rome. There's always turmoil, always little pockets of resistance, zealots and Sicarii was one of the other groups out there that were fighting the Romans in armed resistance. And here they are rejecting their king and embracing Caesar. That's how much they hated the Son of God. That they would reject him and embrace the hated foreign Gentile ruler that had put such a burden on them and been such a just demeaning that the proud Jews would once again be under foreign power, because they had had the brief period of independence before this. So, but anyway, but here they go, rejecting Christ for Caesar. Verse number 13, then Pilate therefore heard that saying, so it's like, that changed his mind once they threatened to throw him out of office. He brought forth Jesus and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now, where this place is, we don't know. I wish we did. Unfortunately, and one of the reasons we have such a hard time with this is because, of course, in 70 AD, during the Jewish revolt, which I just spoke of, when Titus captured Jerusalem, they basically tore the entire city down. Christ had prophesied that not one stone would be left upon another, and that's basically what they did. They wanted to annihilate the very memory of Jerusalem, so they basically tore the entire town apart. It was just a pile of smoldering rubble and decaying bodies by the time they got done with it. And, you know, of course, when that happens, most of the buildings disappear. You know, they're just piles of rubble. And to make it even harder, the Emperor Hadrian in the 2nd century, 120s or 130, I think it was 120s AD, I don't remember the exact year, built a new town on top of there, Aelia Capitolina, I believe is how you say it. And actually on the old Temple Mount, built a temple to Jupiter and tried to establish a Roman city at the site of Jerusalem. So a lot of the ancient ruins that are there only go back to the time of Aelia Capitolina. I hope I'm saying that right. Or perhaps, you know, if you see the pictures of the walls or you've been there, a lot of that actually even goes back to the Byzantine era, a few centuries later, or to the Crusaders, the times of the Crusaders. So very little, very, very little actually remains in Jerusalem that's not just rubble or just, you know, just discarded trash, basically, of Jerusalem that Christ walked. Now, there are, you know, streets that they have found. They found remains of pools and remains of buildings and such. There's the Wailing Wall that is remaining at the Temple Mount. That's the only remaining wall from that structure. But there's very little as far, you know, placing things like this place, the pavement, or the even the Praetorium or the High Priest House. It's up for a lot of debate. Now, there's tradition that says, you know, oh, this is where this happened. But much of that is very, very shady. Basically, a lot of that dates back to once Rome became a Christian nation, quote unquote. I'll have to do a whole lesson on that sometime. But the individuals would go over there seeking to find these holy sites and would basically the way it worked was they would find somebody and say, hey, I'll give you $10 if you can show me where this happened. And they say, $10? Oh, sure, it happened right over here. I'll show you exactly where it happened. You know, but of course, by that time, you know, these weren't exactly Christians that they were speaking to. In most cases, and the fact that the town had already been, you know, the buildings had already been destroyed and rebuilt and destroyed and rebuilt. So it's pretty unlikely that many of the sites that the Catholics claim are authentic. It is very, very likely that many of them are not. In fact, it's very likely that many of the sites, period, that are claimed to be the authentic sites in and around Jerusalem are not authentic. We do not know the exact location of many places that we wish we did. Now, we think we do. We think we know where the Garden of Gethsemane is. We think we know where Golgotha was. We think we know even where the Garden Tomb was. But all those, there's some debate on those. We're not exactly sure. So, as I wish I knew where this... Well, I got on a sidetrack. I wish I knew where this place was, this pavement. It evidently, what this place was like a forum-type area where they would do official business. And I think it's kind of like what I was speaking about, where Pilate could be up on a elevated like balcony or platform and address the crowd, and there was a big open area for the people to come in and hear him. So, but anyway, takes Jesus and they go there. Verse number 14, and it was the preparation of the Passover, and about the sixth hour, and he saith unto the Jews, behold your king. So one last time, he's going to offer him to the Jews, and they reject him. And so this takes place probably around 6-7 o'clock in the morning, something like that. So, you know, shortly after dawn. Verse number, where am I at? Boy, and by the way, this actually referenced back to Zechariah. Let me see if I can find Zechariah here real quick. You can tell I don't edit my podcast because of things like this. Zechariah 9, verse 9, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass and upon the colt of the foal of an ass. Behold thy king. Behold thy king. Zechariah 9, 9. What does Pilate say? Says, behold your king. Behold your king. I see the reference. I see a connection there. Here he is, their king, their Messiah. One last time. How many times has he presented them? How many times? Just right here. I mean, is this what, the second or third time that Pilate has presented them to the Jews? Say, look, here he is. You can have him back. And yet every time they say, no, away with him. Crucify him. Here's the final offer of the Messiah to the Jewish nation, and they reject him. It says, and he saith unto the Jews, behold your king. Verse number 15, one of the saddest, saddest verses in the Bible. But they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. We don't even want him around. Take him away. Take him away. Crucify him. Put him to death. Pilate saith unto them, shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. That, in and of itself, is blasphemy, at least borderline blasphemy. The high priests were supposed to be there as representatives of God. And yet here they are saying, we do not want our Messiah. We do not want our king. We'd rather have the pagan Gentile Caesar as our ruler. And you know, they got what they asked for. And it didn't work out very well. They rejected their Messiah. Cost them their nation. Cost them their temple, led to over 1,900 years. It was called the diaspora, the dispersion, where the Jews didn't have a homeland, spread out all throughout the world because they said, we don't want our king. We don't want our Messiah. We'd rather have Caesar. The Messiah who will be the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who will rule during that millennial kingdom when the lion shall lay down with the lamb. That Messiah, they traded all of that for what Caesar gave them. What did Caesar give them? Slavery. Jesus promised them the Messiah would bring a throne, restore the Davidic throne. He would give them peace, give them prosperity, establish Israel as the center of the world. Instead, under Caesar, they lost their nation. They just about lost their identity. Lost it all. For about 1,900 years, they didn't even have a homeland. until it was restored. And now there they are. The Jews are once again back in there and setting up for end time events. And one day they will realize what they did. One day they will embrace their Messiah. Because their Messiah is coming. Yes, he is coming back. There's a twofold coming of Christ. The first time he came as a lowly babe in Bethlehem. He came to suffer and die and to purchase our pardon, the redemption of mankind. But the next time he comes, he's coming as a king. He's coming back riding a white horse. He will defeat his enemies at the Battle of Armageddon. He will rule and reign for 1,000 years. He's coming back. All those prophecies about the conquering regal Messiah, they're not void. They're going to come true. They're coming. That's what happens with the millennial kingdom. But the Jews rejected all that. They rejected their Messiah and embraced Caesar. Verse number 16. Then delivered he him, therefore, unto them to be crucified, and they took Jesus and led him away. So he's turned over to the executioners, which appear to be 4 Roman soldiers. And verse 17. And he, bearing his cross, went forth into a place called the place of a skull, which is called in the Hebrew Golgotha, which means place of the skull. If this is a place we believe it is, it's a little hill that would have been outside the walls of Jerusalem. It had to be outside the city to fulfill prophecy. Christ carried the cross, of course, part of the way. Simon of Cyrene carried it a little farther once Christ was just physically unable to carry on. They went outside to that hill. Verse number 18, where they crucified him, and 2 other with him, one on either side, and Jesus in the midst. They took him there, laid him on an old rugged cross, put nails through his feet and his hands, and there they crucified the Son of God. There mankind looked at their Creator, rejected him, and killed him. But as I say, and as I've said many times in the previous few lessons, as dark as these events are, it's not without a purpose. There's a reason for it. And the story's not over there. It does not end with the cross. Jesus is going to die, yes. His blood will be shed, yes. But he will be victorious. He will conquer death. He will conquer hell. He will conquer sin. He will conquer the grave. And he will then offer to mankind the greatest gift, salvation, freedom, redemption. It all had a purpose. That's why Jesus died. That's why all of this took place, was so that man might be restored in their relationship with God. Next lesson, we'll deal with the death of Christ. And we will deal with his burial and deal with the circumstances and such around it. And then finally, next lesson after that, lesson number 37, we'll deal with our risen Savior. And after that, we only have one more lesson left. Well, I appreciate you listening. I know this lesson has gone a very long time. We're just nigh of an hour long. But I appreciate you listening. I hope this has been a help and a blessing to you. Thanks for listening.